From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When you talk to any of the Nicaraguan people, it's clear that their fear is not the Soviet Union, their fear is not communism, their fear is the constant attacks on the people of Nicaragua being supported by the U.S. government.
27-year-old American Ben Linder. 10 years ago today, he was executed by the Nicaraguan Contras.
Who killed Ben? Someone. Who was paid by someone. Who was paid by someone. And down the line to the President of the United States.
My name is John Linder. I'm 32 years old. And Ben Linder was my only brother. The United States government killed my brother.
Also, the first ever National Conference on Police Brutality, and a feminist look at the Jewish Passover holiday with the Seder Sisters.
We are still like a lost tribe. Men still want to sing solo at the Seder, in the Knesset, in the synagogue, and at the wall. Men still insist on making laws that govern women's wombs. While men still seek to silence our voices, Miriam's daughters must sing sweeter, bolder, louder.
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. They've given up their hostages, but the standoff continues in West Texas. A militant separatist group remains holed up in the home of captives they freed earlier today near Fort Davis, about 220 miles south of El Paso. Group members took two neighbors hostage and held them for more than 12 hours. The couple was freed when the government released a jailed member of the group. The group is also demanding a referendum on Texas independence. At least three dozen local and state officials have surrounded the area. The self-styled ambassador for the Republic of Texas has told a San Antonio newspaper that the group has now dug in. Negotiations are expected to resume today. And disgraced former Los Angeles police detective Mark Furman was the grand dragon of an anti-female police group and wore a hood at tribunals held to punish male officers who refused to shun female officers. This, according to a report in the New York Daily News today. Furman, whose bigoted tape-recorded comments were a major part of O.J. Simpson's criminal trial, described putting on a hooded sweatshirt to preside at beer-fueled mock trials held at night at a baseball field. Furman's racist remarks on the tapes led his plea of no contest to a perjury charge last year. This news from Lima. Peru buried its heroes. Two soldiers killed rescuing 71 hostage and a captive who died in the raid, while all but one of the rebels were buried in funerals not attended by their families. Peruvian television and radio reported today that 13 of the 14 rebels, including leader Nestor Serpa, were buried in cemeteries throughout Lima without the knowledge of relatives, many of whom live in the remote jungle far from the capital. Nestor Serpa's mother says from France she will sue the government of Japan for the execution of her son. Embassies are considered the property of the country they represent. Meanwhile, the German government has called on the city-state of Hamburg to ban political activity by the international spokesperson for the rebel group involved in the Lima hostage crisis. The move followed a Peruvian media report that Lima's foreign ministry had asked Germany to cancel political asylum status granted in 1993 to Isaac Velasco. The government sources said Chancellor Helmut Kohl's cabinet had authorized the interior minister to contact Hamburg officials, but the sources added there was no grounds to cancel political asylum under German law. Meanwhile, in Copenhagen, Danish police said today that young demonstrators occupied Peru's consulate general in Copenhagen to support rebels who were killed in Lima as commandos freed their hostages last week. They said, "We have no clear picture of the situation at the moment, but it seems that some young people are hanging out of the building's window and shouting slogans." The agency quoted a spokesperson for the Committee for the Release of MRTA Prisoners in Peru as saying the action was taken in sympathy for the 14 Tupac Amaru Revolutionary Movement rebels who died in the hostage-freeing raid by the Peruvian army last week. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Civil rights groups this weekend held the first ever national conference on police brutality. Organized by the New York-based Center for Constitutional Rights and co-sponsored by groups ranging from Amnesty International to the United Church of Christ, the meeting looked at ways to stem police misconduct and promote increased community control over the police. Reporting on this weekend's conference is Jose Santiago. He's news director at Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
All we have left is memories. All we have left is pictures of our kids. We are in pain. We go through pain every single day. The only way we have remembers is to put murals, because that's what I've done about my son. I put up a mural. Why? To bring the attention to the community that these two young men were shot point blank in the back so many times.
Margarita Rosario, head of the New York-based Parents Against Police Brutality, describing the death of her son and nephew in a police killing now being investigated by the U.S. Justice Department. As in so many similar cases, local prosecutors exonerated the two officers involved in the shooting, a pattern that conference organizers say is being repeated all too often in municipalities across the country.
This is not just a New York problem or a Mississippi problem or a Detroit problem or a Buffalo problem, but the problem is in Cincinnati. Ohio also.
Nathaniel Livingston Jr. is an activist with the Cincinnati Rainbow Push Coalition and the Cincinnati Black Marchers. He is one of dozens of people who, during several open mic sessions, described what they felt were instances of police abuse in their respective communities.
On February the 23rd of this year, we had a brother named Lorenzo Collins, who was a mental patient. He had a history of mental problems. He had been taken to the local hospital to be put under a 72-hour mental observation. The brother escaped from the mental institution, and the police were called to capture him as if he were an animal. What they did was they cornered this brother, four police officers, four armed officers, and this brother apparently reached down and picked up a brick. And because he had this brick in his hand, they shot and killed Lorenzo Collins. Two officers fired approximately four bullets and killed this brother. And they said that the brick was a deadly weapon, and they felt like he threatened them, and that's why they had to kill him.
Co-sponsored by Amnesty International and a number of other rights organizations, the conference also sought to develop strategies to fight police brutality. Danielle Straw is with Copwatch, a Berkeley, California group that is part of a growing effort in Northern California in which community residents arm themselves with video cameras to monitor police.
Teach people what their rights are when they're observing the police and try to help people do it in the most safe way. We're there not to excite the police more. We're trying to keep calm situation down. So, you know, we go out there as a team of cop watchers who are, you know, trained and you know, do this street observation of the police. And but our goal really is that everybody, all the time, every citizen, when they see the police dealing with the community resident, with anybody in their community, that they stop. And if everybody stops and watches, the police, wouldn't be able to get away with the things they do as much.
One of the conference's main focus was the growing number of police departments across the country that have developed youth initiatives, such as the program in Atlanta, where a young person could be arrested for driving through certain downtown streets twice during a given two-hour period. Liz O'Yan is with the Asian American Legal Defense and Education Fund.
They're so scared, you know, when they confront the police and the police start asking them questions, that their natural tendency is to respond. But they need to be reminded that their statements can be used against them, and they have an absolute right to have an attorney present, and they shouldn't be intimidated by the police, and the teenagers need to know their rights.
Another focus of discussion was the role of civilian review boards charged with investigating police misconduct. The consensus among conferees was that most review boards have not been given the investigative powers and political independence needed to adequately restrain police misconduct. Hector Soto, former head of the Civilian Complaint Review Board in New York City, noted that review boards must be expanded to include civilian oversight even at the local district or precinct levels.
The commander of the local precinct, the local chief of police, has to know that when he or she makes a decision, whether it's about how people are deployed or who the bad guys or bad, you know, gals are in that department, that it's going to have repercussions, that his job or her job is going to be on the line, that he or she is going to have to explain to a group of citizens who live there and represent the community why he or she is allowing this cop, who is brutal, who is insensitive, who doesn't give a damn about the community, to be out there patrolling the streets.
And Michael Deutsch, former legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, called for what he termed the internationalization of the struggle against police brutality. Deutsch said international law establishes universal standards for police performance and provides rules and covenants to prohibit police abuse. He says the legal community should seek to develop cases against individual departments on those grounds. And, said Deutsch, activists should work to bring lawsuits against police departments that consistently fail to discipline repeat offenders.
In Chicago, 1 to 2% of the police officers commit 25% of the police brutality. There are in every police department in this country a core group of police officers who are committing the majority of the acts of police brutality and police violence. This doesn't say that there are good or bad police officers. What it says is there are those who continually commit acts of brutality, and these are the ones that we must target and we must bring lawsuits to get rid of.
Conference organizers say they will announce a formal action plan in the next few weeks. However, they have already committed to seek regional congressional hearings on police brutality and to formalize a network of activists from around the country who are working on the issue.
Why are they not responding to our kids? They're human beings.
Again, Margarita Rosario, whose son and nephew died at the hands of New York City police.
My son lived a short life. He was only 18 years old when his life was taken. My nephew was only 21 years old. These kids had a future. These kids had plans for the future. They wanted to be someone when they got older. So I say to the community, please continue to struggle. These names, these stories must continue to come out, and we must not let these kids go, these kids' life go in vain. Thank you.
For Democracy Now!, this is Jose Santiago reporting from New York.
And thank you very much for that report, Jose. Jose Santiago has won 2 Golden Reels from the National Federation of Community Broadcasters for his reports on the case of Anthony Baez, a young Bronx man who died in a police chokehold after his football hit a police car. And now we move south and back a decade, but also to the story of a son who was murdered. He was a clown, a unicyclist, a political activist, and a hydroelectric engineer. His name was Ben Linder. He was murdered 10 years ago today in the mountains of Nicaragua. U.S.-funded Contras executed him while he was working with a group of Nicaraguan peasants to build a dam. Before we go to Ben Linder's parents in Portland, Oregon, we're going to play an excerpt of a documentary. This excerpt on news reports the day of his death and of his funeral.
Un ciudadano norteamericano identificado como Benjamín Ernesto Linder, de 27 años de edad, originario de Portland.
A United States citizen identified as Benjamin Ernest Linder, 27 years of age, originally from Portland, Oregon, has been assassinated by counter-revolutionary mercenaries. The act occurred today, April 28th, at 8 o'clock in the morning, while Benjamin Ernest Linder was working on a project to construct a small hydroelectric plant. Linder was carrying out this project to benefit Nicaraguan peasants. He did not receive a salary. He raised the funds to do this work with North American solidarity. While working as a volunteer, he was assassinated by mercenaries who are directed by the president of his country, Ronald Reagan.
Cuando lo asesinaron los mercenarios que dirige el presidente de su país, Ronald Reagan.
Linder was one of a number of U.S. volunteers in Nicaragua working to improve living conditions there. Linder, age 27, had been helping build a hydroelectric plant that brought electricity to a region that previously had had none.
The Nicaraguan government says the Portland, Oregon engineer was executed by the Contras.
He is the first American volunteer to die in Nicaragua. The killing marks a new turn in the Contra war, where suddenly Central Americans are no longer the only victims.
Linder's parents arrived in Managua today.
Who killed Ben? Someone who was paid by someone, who was paid by someone, and down the line to the President of the United States.
My name is John Linder. I'm 32 years old, and Ben Linder was my only brother. The United States government killed my brother.
President Daniel Ortega of Nicaragua delivered the eulogy himself.
Por quien dobla las campanas, escribía Hemingway.
For whom do the bells toll, wrote Hemingway, while fire was incinerating the people of Spain. But the song and hope of the people of Garcia Lorca rose up over the ashes left by fascism. Today we are gathered before Benjamin Linder, citizen of the United States, who, filled with love and happiness, gave his life for the campesinos of Nicaragua. He knew the risks of work in Nicaragua, of the danger of going into the mountains, into the communities, to contribute with his knowledge, his dedication, and with his example, to improve the living conditions of the people in the countryside. He did not arrive on a flight carrying arms, nor millions of dollars. He came on a flight carrying dreams, dreams born out of his conviction that the ethical values of the American people are above the illegal policy of the United States government towards Nicaragua. He demonstrated that the American people are noble, that the people of the United States are not the supporters of the assassins of Nicaraguan children, women, young people, and campesinos. He proved that the people of Abraham Lincoln are enemies of slavery, enemies of terrorism, and firm defenders of peace between people. He lived and died for the American people and for the Nicaraguan people. From San Jose de Bocay, where the mercenaries carrying out the plans of the CIA killed him, to El Cua, Rio San Juan, Oregon, and Washington, the song of love, full of peace, and the hope of Benjamin Linder is multiplied by his sacrifice. No to war, yes to peace. Benjamin's blood cries out so that the bells do not continue to toll in Nicaragua.
That was former Nicaraguan President Daniel Ortega. He was followed by Ben Linder's father, David, being translated by his mother, Elizabeth.
So I have to speak in English.
Con mis disculpas porque no sé hablar su idioma de ustedes, tendré que hablar en inglés.
He was an engineer. He wanted to go somewhere where he could help people. He chose Nicaragua, fresh into its revolution for freedom, where the important thing is people and what you can do to help them. He came here to apply his trade and develop hydropower for the country of Nicaragua.
Él vino aquí para trabajar en lo que él había aprendido y desarrollar. Y desarrollar servicio eléctrico para en este país.
He soon went up to the El Cua area to finish, to work as an engineer to finish the hydropower facility that was begun in that city. It brought him to the reality that through work, you can help people make their lives better and give them the freedoms they need to grow into a healthy, democratic country. He gave his life to this end. It's clear that many people here love him and appreciate what he's done. And for that, I'm very grateful. Me and my family are proud to have him come to rest in your city.
Yo y mi familia estamos orgullosos sabiendo que él va a quedar en paz aquí en el pueblo de ustedes. Gracias.
And Ben Linder's brother, John Linder.
Because Nicaragua represents hope. It represents hope for the people of the world. It is because of the hope, because of the example that Nicaragua is to the world, that the government of my country has is carrying out a war against you. But this hope is too deep to die with one person or to die with the 15,000 of you who have died.
And finally, Miriam, Ben's sister.
The pain that our family is feeling now is a greater and deeper pain than any we have ever known. It is impossible, but we try to imagine that pain multiplied by the thousands who've given their lives in the revolution and in the continuing fight for the freedom of Nicaragua. Ben's family, his friends, all who knew him, wish to thank the people of Nicaragua for their strength and their dream, which allowed Ben to lead a full and meaningful life.
The Linder family at the funeral of Ben Linder 10 years ago today. This sound, the archival sound from a documentary called They Can Cut All the Flowers, But They Will Never Stop the Spring. And when we come back, we'll speak with Elizabeth and David Linder, Ben's parents. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. This weekend in Eugene, Oregon, and also in Portland, hundreds of people attended gatherings and in Eugene, a three-day symposium looking back on Ben Linder's life, the U.S. Contra war against the Sandinista government, and the legacy of Ben Linder. Right now, we go out to Portland, Oregon, to Ben's parents, Elizabeth and David Linder. We welcome you to Democracy Now! And David Linder, maybe you can tell us why Ben Linder went to Nicaragua.
Oh, Ben went to Nicaragua about 3.5 years before he was killed to see what he could do to improve the life of the people. He took all his engineering books, took his unicycle and his juggling material, and went down there to see what he if he could help. He ended up working for the Utilities Company of Nicaragua. It's a national utility, ENA, and first on geothermal power, and then was asked if he was interested in developing a hydroelectric plant in El Cuá, which was a very remote area of northern Nicaragua. It was started before, it was just left unworked because of the intense Contra activity in the region. Ben liked the idea of working on a hydroelectric plant himself. He liked the idea of the fact that it was a mini hydroelectric plant. He felt small was beautiful. And he liked the concept of doing something on his own. He went up there and became the engineer to complete the hydroelectric plant in El Cuá. When that was completed, some other internationalists and Nicaraguans thought of a more far-reaching project, and that was to set up a independent unit to work in that part of the country to develop hydroelectric power, to get a clean water system going, to empower the people, to control the things by which they found critical for their life, and with schools and the like, health care and the like.
How long was he in Nicaragua for?
About 3.5 years. And Ben was working, trying to find the best site for another hydroelectric plant. And he, the time that he was killed, ended up in San Jose de Bocay, where he was checking out a stream in that, going through that community when he was ambushed, murdered, assassinated, if you will, along with two Nicaraguan helpers, Sergio Hernandez and Pablo Rosales.
Let me ask Elizabeth Linder how you know what happened that day.
Well, there were survivors of the ambush. You know, Ben and Sergio and Pablo were killed, but there were those. There was one who was wounded, and I think there were three or four others. Not only that, but the Contra, who were part of that ambush, spoke, and although their information was somewhat canned, I mean, 6 or 8 or 12 people all had identical reports, so identical that they couldn't have been quite correct. But what we know from the survivors is that, and the Contras themselves said that, they knew that these people were working on a hydroelectric project, and that essentially that is why they ambushed and killed them. And part of that, our guess is that some years before, the CIA issued a manual which targeted electricity power projects.
Why electricity power projects in particular?
Because they targeted all the things that made life better for poor people who never had electricity, who had not had schools, who had no access to medical care. Those were the things they targeted. They shot up ambulances, they killed health workers, they killed development workers who were making life better.
But until that day, they had not killed an American.
Not an American, but they had killed, I can't remember if it was 8 or 10 other internationalists, not to speak of all the Nicaraguans, many of whom were also, I remember reading in our paper in the Oregonian, I can't remember what year, that two teachers going back after Christmas vacation to teach in El Cua had been killed.
Did Ben realize the danger he faced?
Yes, he did.
But he decided to go anyway.
Yes. And I think one of the things that I remember his either saying or writing about was that he was working with and for Nicaraguans, and they didn't have the luxury of being able to leave. And I think he really wanted to live as they did, as closely as he could.
Of course, I'm sure that day is indelibly marked in your memories, the day of Ben's funeral in Nicaragua. But looking now at video footage of the funeral, thousands of Nicaraguans came out. Do you think Ben would have ever dreamed that he would have been remembered by so many?
No, I don't think so. And I once asked a Nicaraguan why so much adulation for Ben, for the North American, when they were facing the loss of a child, a brother, a husband, a father, day in and day out. And what she said to me was, because he was not from here. He gave his life for another people. For us, it's our own. Like, it's obvious that we struggle to make our lives better. But why should someone who could have had it easy somewhere else come here and do this for us?
When you came back to the United States, you both went and testified before Congress.
Yes.
The subcommittee meets today to explore the issue of U.S. volunteers in Nicaragua.
And what he wanted to do was to bring hydropower to this, to remote areas in the country, so they could become self-sufficient, proud, productive people.
Okay. I would suggest that the committee would be intensely interested, since you have a background in medicine, if you could describe to us what you have ascertained concerning the circumstances under which your son was killed.
So in my reconstruction, Ben was killed by a gunshot wound to his head, fired at point blank after he was immobilized. This was an ambush, not a chance encounter. It was murder. I consider the United States government and its effectors, the Contras, guilty of this crime. It was not an accident, but the result of the United States foreign policy.
The reason I find this so difficult is I don't want to be tough on you, but I really feel that you've asked for it. I think that you're being here. I think you're being here today. It's been less than 3 weeks since your son died.
That was about the most cruel thing you could have said. He had a commitment to his job and to the people he was working with. You know, I think if more of us had more of a commitment to do what we set out to do, he became a mechanical engineer. He found a place where he could work in his profession and learn things and do things and contribute.
Elizabeth Linder, what was that all about, this confrontation with Florida at the time Congress member Connie Mack?
Well, we had been asked, David actually had been asked to testify before the committee, and I cannot at this point tell you what the name of that committee was. And I essentially, David said he wouldn't go if I didn't go, and they said they were investigating Ben's death, Ben's murder. And we were there and speaking, and at some point, David was speaking, I didn't say very much, but at some point Connie Mack said, I believe, how could you have allowed your son to be up there? And I said something about he was a grown man and he made his own decisions. Connie Mack said, I don't remember the exact quote, but something like he chose to be on the wrong side. He got what he deserved. And I, if I remember correctly, said that was the most cruel thing he could have said, that anybody could have said to us. And this was about 2 weeks after Ben's murder.
Yet since that time, Violeta Chamorro was elected and the Sandinistas went down to defeat in an election where many said that they didn't want to be invaded by the United States like Panama was, and they thought maybe the killing would stop, the U.S. would stop funding the Contras if the Sandinistas were no longer there. But the project that Ben was working on did continue. Can you talk about the hydroelectric dam that he was contemplating the day he was killed?
At the time of the funeral, we sat around with Ben's colleagues after the ceremony, and they said that they wanted to continue with Ben's work and continue to build a hydroelectric plant. And we just said, go for it. And by the way, how much was the hydroelectric plant cost? And of course, they didn't know, and they came up with a number of, I think, $20,000 or something, which is just obviously an invention. And $200,000 is what they said. Elizabeth corrected me. Thank you. And So he looked, said, okay, it's fine. Until now, our family is just a family. We never did anything more than have a garage sale now and then. And for us to say, sure, was something that we never had experienced before. And after I came back, we found people who would help us raise money for the project. We spoke in, I think, 50 states in the country, Miriam, John, Elizabeth, and me. And we had to bring two of Ben's close friends in from four of Ben's close friends in to the United States to help out. We collected $700,000, not from any big donors, but basically from mostly from small donors who contributed $25 or so to the project. But the outpouring of support throughout the country is testimony for what Ben meant to this particular country. We also got good contributions from Canada and elsewhere also. And a hydroelectric plant was built at the stream where Ben was murdered.
David and Elizabeth Linder, the parents of Ben Linder, who was executed 10 years ago today when he was working with Nicaraguan peasants in the mountainside to build a hydroelectric dam. He had been in Nicaragua for 3.5 years. We want to go back to you both to get phone numbers where people can contact you at the Ben Linder Memorial Fund for the work that you're doing and the newsletter you're putting out. But in this last few minutes before we end the segment, I wanted to turn to Magda Enriquez. And she is the representative of the Sandinistas here in the United States. And she went out along with many other people, including Margaret Randall, including Barbara Kingsolver, the author, to Eugene, Oregon this weekend, to the University of Oregon at Eugene for the 3-day conference on Ben Linder's significance. And Magda Enriquez, I wanted to ask you about the legacy that Ben Linder leaves.
Well, I am teaching now in an inner city school in Philadelphia. And I tell you something, when I'm working with Afro-Americans and when I'm working with Puerto Ricans in that school, and when I look around there, I cannot help it but see Ben as I saw him once in El Cuá, in his unicycle with his clown dress, making people happy. And I do keep him in my mind in that sense. I mean, here is a human being who tried to contribute to a better life to other human beings. And I think this is the greatest lesson that we can learn from him. For him, there were no borders. For him, there were no nations. For him, there was only people, people who need to help each other. And I do believe that this celebration of life in his 10th anniversary has to be for us a commitment to life and a commitment to continue contributing to a better life for all of our peoples.
David and Elizabeth Linder, can you give us the phone number of the newsletter that you continue to put out?
It's the Ben Linder Memorial Fund, and the phone number is 503-227-5803.
One more time.
Area code 503-227-5803.
And again, I want to thank you very much to both of you for joining us. And we want to go out today with the words of Ben Linder himself. Ben Linder himself more than 10 years ago, because on this day 10 years ago, he was killed by the U.S. Contras. But he talked about why he went to Nicaragua.
Then looking around at how I could be useful with my engineering, how I could best serve humanity and our planet Earth, and realizing that here in Nicaragua there's a definite effort to try to rebuild the country and rebuild it along a more humanitarian line.
And that was Ben Linder being interviewed more than 10 years ago. We'd love to hear your comments on today's show. You can call us at 1-202-588-0999, extension 313. That's 202-588-0999, extension 313. You can also send us email at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. You can get a copy of today's show, a cassette copy, by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we continue today's program after our break with another story about mothers. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow, the Jewish observance of Passover ends. The eight-day holiday celebrates the Jewish liberation from slavery in ancient Egypt. Traditionally, on the first two nights of Passover, Jewish families hold dinners or seders, where friends and families gather to tell the story of the Exodus. 5 years ago, I went to an unusual seder in New York City, begun in 1976 by Gloria Steinem and Jewish feminist writers Esther Broner and Phyllis Chesler. The feminist Passover dinner celebrated women and liberation. I produced the following piece for Pacifica Station WBAI in New York.
It's 6 o'clock. The women are arriving. In the dining room, there's no table, just two large sheets spread on the floor. Sheets covered with candles and one candelabra of little clay people with their arms reaching upward. You can put candles in each little hand. The women bring wine and dishes of food to share and put them in the living room for later. For now, aromas waft through the apartment. After a while, as more than 20 women fill the rooms, mothers and daughters and friends, Esther Broner calls the Seder to order. Actually, Seder means order, and the book that contains the ritual prayers and stories is called the Haggadah, Hebrew for the telling. Esther began writing her version of the Haggadah 16 years ago.
Welcome. This is our 16th Seder. This is the 16th time we've gathered together during the month of Nisan. Our reading in the synagogue this month was Leviticus, the listing of sacrifices. It makes me wonder what we as feminists sacrifice to gain a kind of spirituality, a closeness to holiness, or how we define holiness. So sacrifice is much on my mind. And war was the theme we settled on, and plagues we live under. For some of us, the war is not over. As a feminist, after reading Leviticus, as one of the tribe of Levi, the psalm writer, the singer at the temple, like Miriam, I would sacrifice. And first of all, patriotism from Patri, the father, the fatherland.
So this is our when did you write this, Haggadah?
1976, but we revise it every year. Each year, the people around bring new ideas to it. So every one of the Seders for the last 16 years has been different.
What happened in 1976 that you did this?
We declared the Seder of the North, I and three friends, one in Knesset, Marcia Friedman, a social worker named Nomi Nimrod, and I. I was teaching in Haifa, Israel then. And we no longer wanted to serve. We no longer wanted to cook. We wanted to meditate. So we declared the men the cooks, and the cleaners and the servers, and the women the meditators. And we wrote new prayers that ultimately became this Haggadah. And the men were not altogether happy. But it began something quite radical. And then Nomi and I spent the rest of the spring term. I was teaching in Haifa, and she was actually attending my class, as was Marshall when she came in from Knesset. And I spent the rest of the spring term writing that. Every day we went and met, and we wrote it in her late father's study. He was a cantor, and Nomi was very nervous that we were doing something desecrating. Ultimately, we were so angry with what we discovered as we began reading about the Exodus and no women, about male attitudes towards women, that we knew that we had to make our own Exodus, and that's what happened in 76. So it was that long ago, and Ms. published in April of 77 about a third of it, which people still kill for.
What do you mean that the Exodus was only men?
Well, you read who left Egypt each time. Maybe there was one woman who left. And even when Miriam crossed the sea, she sang the same song that Moses did. She never had her own words. So by and large, the Exodus was the history of men. And it took five women to rescue Moses. It never tells about how many women it takes to rescue a woman and to make her a leader. So we felt it was a kind of paradigm that we could work with, and it turned out it had a lot of effect. To my enormous surprise, it was very popular, even in the Xeroxed form. Even pioneer Hadassah Naamat women used it. Your most traditional of women were enraged by what they felt was the cleaning, which I'm now in the process of doing, the cleaning of the cupboards, the changing of dishes, ultimately the serving. And what your big worry is to keep the meal hot. And it seems to me that religion doesn't have anything to do with hot meals. Of meditation, of planning, of being together. But it is not the traditional sweet 16. We gather in strength of our 16th year, determined not to be sweet or nice Jewish girls, but to meet constantly, subversively, insistently, and to invite, to honor those left out of the Seder, our foremothers, our singer Miriam, and to give her new songs, not war songs, but songs of crossing the sea, songs of the timbrel, songs of marching into the unknown, and with the women, with the strength, saving one's people.
Bruchat yashinatenu mekor habracha shehechianu vekimanu vehigianu lasman hazeh.
Spread between us as sisters, and more people came into it. We now have seven of us who make it, three of us who sort of inspire it, Bella and Gloria, who wasn't able to be here today, and Grace Paley. And each year we invite a new person. Each of us invites usually one new person, sometimes more, hoping that they will go forth like little cells, form their own feminist satyrs, and learn to reshape religion.
So what we're going to do is introduce ourselves by our matrilineage, our mothers, our grandmothers, our great-grandmothers, and by our new matriarchs. So let's go, let's see, we'll start to the left.
I'm not quite sure I know what you mean by a new matriarch. You mean somebody I choose to be a matriarch?
Yes.
Does it have to be alive or dead?
No, either one. It should be either one.
Well, since Bella isn't here, it'll be Bella Abzug.
That's all I feel.
I'm Jenny Leia Zlata, and my mother is Michelle next to me. My grandmother, Nachama Leia, and my great-grandmother, Zlata. And
I'm Michelle Michal, but Nachama Leia, but Zlata. And let's make Gloria another of our matriarchs.
I'm Naomi, but Dvorah, but Faye, but Mrs. Grandma.
I'd like to choose Rosa Luxemburg as my matriarch because she was an activist who wrote lots of love letters.
Bat Marisa, Bat Diva,
Bat Esther, Bat Chayasura, and if I can choose non-Jews and non-humans, I'm choosing Jane Goodall and Flo, the old matriarchal chimp, as my matriarch.
My name is Meryl, my mother is Ruth, and my grandmother is Catherine, and I'm still searching for my matriarchs.
Mother of Nechama, daughter of Beatrice, daughter of Nechama, sister of Sivia, my other grandmother. I think my matriarchs are the women who are working for peace. From the WIMPs here on the West Side, women indicting military plans and solutions, to the women in black who have not really been able to stand on their corners in the towns of Jerusalem, I think, since the war began. And I would like instruction in times of peace, how to continue fighting, and in terms of war, how to look towards peace from them.
And from the uncertainty of questions to the certainty of ritual, the blessing of the candles by mother and daughter. Letty and Robin Pogrebin. And then to the annual repetition of the four questions. Traditionally, why is this night different from all other nights? Why do we eat matzah, bitter herbs? Why do we recline while eating? But at this Seder, at Robin's apartment, one of the daughters of the original Seder sisters, the questions were slightly different. They were asked by Jenny Landsberg and answered by her mother, Michelle.
Why is this Seder different from all other Seders? And why do we still feel the need to create a feminist Seder?
Because though it's 15 years since our rabbis, Phyllis and Esther, created a Seder that celebrated the exodus of women, we are still like a lost tribe. Men still want to sing solo at the Seder, in the Knesset, in the synagogue, and at the wall. Men still insist on making laws that govern women's wombs. While men still seek to silence our voices, Miriam's daughters must sing sweeter, bolder, louder.
But next year in Jerusalem, will women rejoice in the Torah at the Western Wall? Will all people pray in equal dignity together? Will the daughters of Pharaoh's daughters join us in the dance?
Our hope and courage.
And to the Litany of Dayenu, the English translation, it would have been enough for us. The song traditionally addresses God and is about abundance. Each verse recounts another thing God did for the Jewish people to liberate them from Egypt. And each verse ends with the word Dayenu. Just one deed would have been enough. The women's Dayenu addresses society and is about scarcity, how women's role in Jewish liberation was scarcely recognized. Each verse recounts one woman's achievement and says if just that had been acknowledged, it would have been enough.
If Chava had been created in the image of God and not as a helper to Adam, Dayenu.
Dayenu. If she had been created as Adam's equal and not been considered a temptress, it would have sufficed.
If she were the first woman to eat from the tree of knowledge and had been recognized as bringing knowledge to us, Dayenu.
If Lot's wife had been honored for compassion and looking back at the fate of her family in Sodom and had not been punished for it, Dayenu.
If our mothers had been honored for their daughters as well as for their sons, Dayenu.
If our mothers had not been considered as hardened roots or as fruit-bearing wombs, but as women in themselves, Dayenu.
If the just women in Egypt who caused our redemption had been given sufficient recognition, Dayenu.
if Miriam were given her seat with Moses and Aaron in our legacy.
Diana. If women had written the Haggadah and placed our mothers where they belonged in history. Diana.
If every generation of women, together with every generation of men, would continue to go out of Egypt. Dayenu, Dayenu.
Dayenu, 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 Dayenu.
How has the Seder and that your women's Haggadah changed over the years? You say you've added things to it. I mean, themes, for example, this year.
We've had the same spine. We go through the same material, because in the best traditional sense of revision, it's based upon the traditional Haggadah, the telling. But some years we declare a Kabbalistic year. Maybe we meditate and think about the number 9. Some years we try to think about what is it that upsets us with each other? Why aren't we working well together? And we have an intergroup mediation. Some years we've talked of losses. 2 years ago, the daughters took it and asked the mothers questions. And it was just deeply moving, probably the best Seder we ever had.
And so this year, the women talked about plagues, some internal and some external.
I think my plague is a sense of incompleteness. As a feminist, I'm very successful in my career, as in a man's career, by the way. And as a Jew, I feel that I'm successful in the sense that I've gotten married and starting a family, which is another sort of male world. But I feel that what I'm not successful at and I'm incomplete at is in the world of women, that all the women my generation were so busy with our careers and our families and trying to juggle both that we've forgotten about each other and that we don't have time for each other. And for me, that's a great loss.
My plague is focused at this moment on my deep alienation from my own people and Israel, and I have never felt that more strongly. My whole young life was structured around the idealism of a collective Zionism, and bit by bit it's been torn apart. And I now feel as though a Red Sea has rushed in, an angry tide between me and Israel. And I see on the far shore a people marching. Their Moses is, I see as a dwarfish Moses screaming, force, might, beatings. And I will never be reconciled. And I will never be reconciled to the pain of being so estranged from my own people. And
did it ever, in your frustration in 1976 and before, did you ever think, just throw the whole thing out, create whole new traditions?
I know the deep feeling of spirituality that women have. I'm very sympathetic to earth religions and seasonal religions, and I'm totally unsympathetic to a hierarchical religion where you bend your back looking up at a god. But the women I'm with, and Benot Aish and other women, sort of work on the edges, trying to incorporate some of the past and trying to find a religion where the creative spirit comes from within rather than above.
Esther Broner hopes someday to publish the Women's Haggadah along with a history of the feminist Seder so that women will be passed over no more. For WBAI News, I'm Amy Goodman. Daughter of Dorothy, granddaughter of Sonia and Gittel, great-granddaughter of Nahama, Gita, Rivka, great-great-granddaughter of Brian.
Well, Esther Broner did write that book. It's called The Telling, published by HarperCollins San Francisco. It's also published The Women's Haggadah, and this year the women gathered for the 22nd annual Seder in New York City, and thousands of women around the country read from that Women's Haggadah. I dedicate this program to my grandmother, Sonia Bach. Today is her 100th birthday, and I still can't keep up with her. If you'd like a cassette copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer is Andy York and Kenneth Mason. Errol Maitland is our assistant producer and engineer in New York. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!